Thank you. I'm going to try to do just a little bit of overview and then respond to your questions. So, you know, this is a case that is caught in a doctrinal transition and a doctrinal ambiguity. So, the court has repeatedly held that the government cannot sponsor prayers in public schools. There pretty clearly are still 5 votes for that proposition. It also held 30 years ago in a case called Marsh v. Chambers that government can sponsor prayers at a state legislature, that there was a tradition all the way back to the founding of legislative prayer. The first Congress had done it, and Nebraska could do it too. It's a short opinion by Chief Justice Berger. It's deeply ambiguous in some ways, and the court had not returned to the question in the intervening 30 years. The court has repeatedly said that government is supposed to be neutral, is between religion and non-religion, that it cannot endorse a particular religion or religion in general, but no one thinks there are 5 votes for that proposition at the moment. But the conservatives, who reject the idea of neutrality as between religion and non-religion, the conservatives have said, well, but government does have to be neutral as between religions. It can't take sides, one religion over another. And then in the Ten Commandments cases a few years ago, Justice Scalia qualified that further. He said, look, when we're talking about government speech, government taking note of religion as with a public prayer in a legislature or a monument or a display with a religious theme, you can't do that at all if it has to be absolutely neutral as among all possible beliefs, right? So you don't pray, people who believe in an unconcerned creator that started the world in motion and takes no further interest, no point in praying to that kind of a god. Polytheists, true polytheists who really believe in multiple gods, they can be excluded. Atheists can be excluded. Just be neutral among the big monotheistic faiths, and that's good enough, Scalia said. And he said this, he said variations in that theme twice, both times in dissent. And in one of those dissents, he said, our constitutional tradition rules out government endorsements of religion that are sectarian in the sense of, and this is pretty close to a quote, specifying details on which believers in an omnipotent and benevolent creator are known to disagree. For example, the divinity of Christ. So that was kind of the doctrinal background. We lashed ourselves onto that Scalia dissent. We, you know, and tried to hold him to it, knowing perfectly well he would wiggle out of it some way. But this was a case in which we were relying pretty heavily on dissents, because the dissenters pretty clearly had 5 votes at this point, and the town was relying simply on Marsh v. Chambers. They said, legislative prayer is constitutionally permissible. Our town council was a legislature. Ergo, prayer at our town council meetings is constitutionally permissible. Now, the question that you heard a few minutes ago was the town's version of the question, right? And you know, they had exclusively Christian prayer givers for 10 years from the beginning of this practice until they knew they were going to be sued. Then they worked in a Jewish layman who was a friend of one of the council members, and a Wiccan priestess who volunteered was allowed to go to prayer 1 month. That produced some political protest and hate mail. And the leader of the Baha'i temple gave the prayer once. So they'd had 4 prayers that were not Christian. All the others were given by Christian pastors, and about 2/3 of them were explicitly Christian. Some just ending in Jesus' name we pray, but a substantial number going into a good bit of theological detail and talking about the saving sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross and so on and so forth. And about 1/3 were non-sectarian, clearly religious, but neutral as among religions. And so we said these town council meetings are different from a state legislature, they're different from Marsh in two ways. One was the sectarian nature of the prayers, and the other was that city councils function in a fundamentally different way from a state legislature. Citizens actively participate in the meetings of a city council. And in Greece, they had some things that you would find at city councils all across the country, and they had some things that were kind of unique to Greece, but they gave a lot of awards to citizens in Greece, and that was a ceremony at the beginning of the meeting right after the prayer. And they swore in their new police officers in a city council meeting. Then there was a public forum in which people could come and speak to the council and often ask for very personal things, you know, ask for solutions to problems that were affecting them personally, and often got action on those problems. And then there was a public hearing part in which people who needed a business permit or a zoning change came to present their case to the city council. And so, and Justice Kennedy, who is here is in so many things a swing vote, Justice Kennedy has said the key to the Establishment Clause is coercion. But at least in the school context, peer pressure counts when it's government-induced. Government pressure counts. It doesn't have to be coercion in a sense of, you know, Scalia says coercion means we'll throw you in jail or we'll fine you. Kennedy says social pressure can count as coercion, and he reserved the question of whether adults are similarly susceptible to that kind of pressure. And we said, look, it's coercive here because the number of citizens in attendance is usually small. There's no anonymity. You decline to participate in the prayer, everyone else stands up or bows their head, and you don't. It's very obvious, or if you step outside, it's very obvious you're refusing to participate in the prayer. And a very few minutes later, you stand up to ask the city council to take discretionary action on your behalf. And so no one will, or almost no one will refuse to participate given that scenario. So we said these prayers are different from the prayers in Marsh because they're sectarian. Marsh was ambiguous on that point, but that was part of our argument, and the other part was this was coercive, and the prayers in Marsh were not because I don't know how many of you have ever seen a state legislature in action, but people wander on and off the floor all the time. It's very easy to avoid the prayer if you want to, and Kennedy had made that point in one of the school cases distinguishing Marsh, talking about how it's easy to avoid the prayer if you're a state legislature, and citizens are not allowed on the floor, and citizens don't participate in a state legislative meeting. They don't get to ask for things there. You know, the lobbying goes on in the lobby or elsewhere. Citizens appear at committee hearings, but they do not appear at the meeting of the legislature itself. So our pitch was, this is different, and you ought to say the prayers have to be non-sectarian, and you ought to say, tell them to do what they can to ameliorate the coercion. And obviously the core of the coercion in this case can't be eliminated. If the real problem is you don't participate in the prayer and then you stand up to ask for discretionary action, they can't solve that. They can't make it go away. So the logical implication of our argument was there shouldn't be any prayers at all. And we didn't say that because nobody could count to five on that. And they hadn't asked for it in the complaint because they didn't think they could get it. And it was way too late to ask for it now, even to just kind of throw it out there and then have a fallback position to ameliorate the coercion. So this case was in part about to what extent are local government city council meetings different from a state legislature. These are the briefs in the Supreme Court. They're color-coded. The green ones are amici. Some of them are always, in a religion case, you always get some nut job amicus briefs that you don't have to worry about too much, but many of them are serious and make important arguments that the parties didn't have room for or elaborate in more detail arguments that the parties made. The government filed a brief on the town side, much to our disappointment. The other thing I would say about the briefs is it's also striking who didn't file on the town side. In all of the conservative religious liberty activist organizations are on one of those amicus briefs, but the churches are not. The Southern Baptist Convention is the only denomination that filed in this case. There's no brief from the Catholic bishops. There's no brief from the Christian Legal Society. There's no brief from the National Association of Evangelicals. No brief from any other denomination. There are a few sort of mainline Protestant and liberal denominations who filed on our side, and the Baptist Joint Committee on Religious Liberty, which is a separationist organization, filed on our side. And some of those organizations, I mean, obviously I wasn't privy to their internal debates with their lawyers, but some of them told me a little bit. Video of these city council meetings is in the record. And at least one of these boards had looked at the video and decided, they just couldn't defend this, that it looked like it looked like the kind of prayer you would expect at a church service, and people didn't really have much choice but to participate in it. I don't know if the court noticed that or not, but we certainly noticed it. So at the argument, we won below, so I was bottom side, I go second. You don't know what's going to happen before you stand up, so I've got a checklist of possible openings. Let me say just a little bit about the Supreme Court, how an argument in the Supreme Court works. The lawyers are a pawn for the justices who are fighting with each other. I assume this is still true, I haven't checked it, but when Walter Dellinger, who used to teach at Duke, was acting Solicitor General at the end of the Clinton administration, they actually counted words in transcripts. The justices talk more than the lawyers. Some of them can ask a clean, crisp question. Breyer can rarely ask a question in under 2 pages. So they talk a lot. They clearly signal which side they're on. Sometimes they're just playing devil's advocate and their vote ultimately surprises you. But, Alito and Scalia should just pick their side and sit at council table. I was up there 2 years ago representing a church in a free exercise case, and they were on my side. This time, of course, they were on the other side, and there was no doubt. They were very, very active. Justice Kagan asked the opening question, and it was one of my openings, right? She said, so I didn't have to do it. She said to the lawyer for the town, suppose a few minutes ago when the Chief Justice called the case, first the marshal had said, all rise for the prayer, and a clergyman had, and then she read one of the more intensely sectarian prayers out of the record, and she says, would that be okay? And he says, no. Well, actually, in their brief, they'd said all three branches of government have this tradition, but he was backing off of that. and so she was pushing him. So they clearly got that people would be reluctant not to participate in the prayer. And Breyer said, I didn't see anybody not standing a few minutes ago. They do have a non-sectarian, which the justices view as a prayer, when they call the court into session, God save the United States and this honorable court. Breyer says, I didn't see anybody not standing. You want to win your case. So they got that part. But they were very deeply worried, particularly the conservatives, about the prospect of censoring prayer. The town invites these pastors to come and give a prayer, and then it gives them guidelines and tells them how to pray and says, we want you to come pray for us, but don't mention Jesus. Well, that's a problem. But it's a problem because we've let government sponsor prayers, right? And so I said, the council decides to have this prayer. The council selects the clergy person to give it. Only he gets to pray. He gets a spot on the agenda. They delegate this task to him. They can define the scope of the delegation. They can tell him what kind of prayer they want. When he's praying for himself or for his congregation or anywhere else on his own time, he can pray any way he wants. But when he's giving the government prayer, he has to comply with the Establishment Clause. And there are some Christian pastors who would say, I can't pray other than in Jesus' name. It'd be incomplete or sacrilegious not to pray in Jesus' name. And somebody asked me that question. I said, well, there are such people. I respect that. They shouldn't be giving government prayers. Right? When you undertake to do a religious task for the government, you undertake it subject to a variety of limitations. So that was our position. The town's position and the government's position was this is just marsh. And their brief said this case could begin and end with marsh. They didn't think there were any differences that mattered. So that kind of sets it up. That's what the argument was like in general. So what else can I tell you about it? Let me hear your questions. If someone asks the first one, many others will follow. Yes, in the back.
What, if anything, unexpected happened to the arguments?
Well, yeah, not a whole lot, but this time there was something unexpected. You get ready for these arguments by trying to anticipate all the questions that you can anticipate and carve your answers down to sound bites on the theory you're only going to get one or two sentences before you're interrupted with the next question. They also interrupt each other. They talk over each other. So interrupting a lawyer, that's nothing, right? So the key to the game is anticipate all the questions, and you partly do that yourself. You probably do it with moot courts. So, 2 years ago, there was no question that had not already been asked in a moot court. This time there was. Alito said, give me an example of a non-sectarian prayer. Well, if I'd thought of that question ahead of time, it would have been easy to have the examples ready. I had not thought of that question. And so, I said, a third of the prayers in this record were non-sectarian. And he said, give me an example. So they hand me the joint appendix, which has all the prayers in it. And I'm flipping through, looking for one, while Roberts is asking another question. And of course, I didn't find one under the time. So I gave him some examples of the kind of language that is used, right? You can pray to the Creator, the Almighty, the Governor of the Universe. I didn't say the easy ones. I didn't say God and Lord, which pretty non-sectarian. I didn't think to say any prayer by the regular Senate chaplain. Just go on the Senate website. He is entirely non-sectarian. So I didn't handle that question very well. And then like 20 minutes later, Alito comes back to it. You never did give me an example, he says. Right? So he was just, told him where he could find an example. That was the best I could do. So that was the least expected thing that happened, and it was kind of obvious that it was unexpected. Who else? Yes?
I'm curious, I haven't read anything obviously like Marx that you mentioned, but I'm curious how originalists like Scalia, however you want to term them, would square the jurisprudence that they support regarding the Establishment Clause with Madison's comments in the attached memoranda.
Yes.
And I'm just curious, there's other documents that sort of contradict that, but I'm just not familiar with
that. More than a few. So Madison's detached memoranda, separation is love to cite because it says, it takes a really hardline view of the Establishment Clause and says, the congressional chaplains were a mistake, wasn't done with my approbation, he says, although he voted for it and he was on the committee that selected the chaplain. This memoranda was written in retirement in 1822. He's out of office. He never has to run for anything again. And even then, he just kept in his papers. It was never published. It was discovered in 1946 and published in a scholarly journal. So it's got some great stuff for the anti-prayer side, but whether it represents anything about the founding besides the musings of an old man is a fair question. Madison and Jefferson did think that the government shouldn't issue Thanksgiving proclamations. Jefferson didn't do it. Madison didn't do it until during the War of 1812 when he was under a lot of political pressure to do it. On the other hand, they plainly did open congressional sessions with prayers. And the conservatives like to say Congress authorized the payment of a chaplain and passed the Establishment Clause in the same week, right? And they obviously didn't think it was unconstitutional. And given our non-sectarianism argument, the town and to some extent the government were pushing hard on, and those early prayers in the first Congress were sectarian. Now, they didn't have many examples because most of them were not recorded. but a few of them were, and they were explicitly Christian prayers. And the Senate hired an Episcopalian as the chaplain, and the House generally hired a Baptist or a Methodist as the chaplain, and they rotated back and forth between the two houses, and the Episcopalian was reading from the Book of Common Prayer, not surprisingly. And so they made a big deal. Not only did they have prayer, they had sectarian prayer. To which I said at the oral argument, I don't know why we didn't figure out to say this earlier, those really weren't sectarian prayers under our definition in 1789. The country was 98.5% Protestant. And so the divinity of Christ was not yet a point on which believers were known to disagree. Today it is a point on which believers deeply disagree, and it deeply bothers many of the non-Christians who are at these meetings. And I mentioned the hate mail and the protest about the Wiccan who gave the prayer. That kind of thing is actually quite common. Anyone but a Christian or a Jew gives the prayer at a government meeting. The person who gives the prayer is at high risk of hate mail and threats, and the city council who let that person give the prayer gets political protests. So many Christians understand the grievance precisely when it happens to them, don't understand it when they're imposing it on everybody else. But the originalism argument here was not so much about particular writings and things that people said. It was about what was the actual practice? What was the first Congress doing? And then the other thing I like, there's this incident in the Continental Congress, which of course is before the Establishment Clause, in which someone proposes they hire a chaplain and someone else says, no, let's not do it. We're such different religious sentiments. We can't all join in the same act of worship. And Sam Adams says, I'm no bigot, and I can hear the prayer of a man of a different faith who's at the same time a friend of his country. And so they were getting as much mileage as they could out of that. And we said, that's about who the prayer giver is. That was not a comment about the content of the prayer. And he probably did not have any deep theological disagreements with the prayer that was actually being offered. In Marsh, Nebraska had used the same Presbyterian minister for 16 years, and the court said that was okay. Our position was the identity of the prayer giver really doesn't matter much here. It's the content of the prayers that it was the focus of the dispute. Yes?
On the question of coercion, you distinguished it from Marsh, how the town meetings were different. But on the question of school prayer, like Levy Weissman and Santa Fe Independent School District, the coercion argument has pretty much been a death sentence for any type of prayer in those situations. How do you reconcile those two cases with Marsh with this case?
Levy Weissman, which he mentioned, was about. Let me step back. The school prayer cases in this country began in state courts in the late 19th century, the Supreme Courts of Illinois and Wisconsin struck down school-sponsored prayers in 1890 and 1908. It doesn't get to the U.S. Supreme Court until the early 60s. And two cases in 62 and 63 say strike down the practice of having a daily prayer and reading of 10 verses from the Bible in the classroom. And then there's a long delay. Took a while to enforce that, but eventually in 1992 they get a case, Levy Weissman, which you mentioned, what about prayer at graduation, and Kennedy said that's coercive, and in 2000 what about prayer at Texas high school football games. That was really a case about two religions. It's the interaction of Christianity and Texas high school football. and Stevens Stevens wrote the opinion for 6 and said, it violates all our standards. It's coercive, it's an endorsement, and it violates the Lemon Test, which is an earlier version of the government has to be neutral between religion and non-religion. And so The premise of the question is right. Prayer in a situation where people can't reasonably avoid or dissent or absent themselves is coercive. Marsh was just, an exception to that, and maybe it is a narrow exception for legislatures, or maybe it's a vastly bigger exception, and this is a rule about children and a rule about adults, and adults are not subject to this kind of social pressure. Well, you can say that if you're announcing a legal rule. It's obviously not true, in fact, and the justices plainly got that it wasn't true, in fact, that people would be unwilling to offend the decision maker they were about to ask for things from. That is very much at issue, right? And so the kind of social and governmental pressure, coercion that comes from the fact that in a few minutes you got to stand up and ask these people for something, is in effect set up against the specter of censoring the prayers. And the court's going to have to choose between one of those evils, right? Yes.
Professor, I was wondering what you anticipate the next big move in the non-sectarian jurisprudence being as religious diversity and plurality increases.
You mean legally or socially and politically?
Legally, what the boundaries of what a non-sectarian prayer?
Right. As we become more and more religiously diverse, what will non-sectarian mean? It's hard to foresee the course of that. I think eventually non-sectarian will mean we don't do prayers at these government events. But the support for them is still pretty broad. In the sense of, I'll talk a little bit about the numbers, but 20-30% of the population has no religious affiliation anymore. But many of those people have no objection. Yes, the follow-up question, and I haven't seen how this question was phrased. I just saw a headline of this poll. Lots of people who are non-believers, or lots of people who said, I strongly support separation of church and state, didn't think the press account of what was going on in Greece was a violation. Right. So the opposition to these kinds of prayers is still clearly a minority position, and the demand to keep up these kind of prayers is very intense from the people who demand it. So that's the political status quo for now and for a good time into the future. And predicting the legal developments obviously depends in part on what happens in this case. And if they give us anything on the non-sectarian issue, that will be a big step. And if they say, look, with adults, the town can pray however the heck it wants, then it'll be a while before you see any developments on the non-sectarian front. You commonly now see this number, 20% of the population is religiously unaffiliated. That does not mean 20% are non-believers. Some of them have rather conventional religious beliefs, but they're just not affiliated with a particular church. Some of them have quite individualistic, sometimes idiosyncratic religious beliefs. These are the people who say, I'm spiritual but not religious. And actually, atheists and agnostics, depends on how you ask the question. Those are not popular labels. So if you say, how many people self-identify as atheist or agnostic, you get numbers like 2-4%. If you say, do you believe that there is a God, the atheist and agnostic answers go up to about 12%, but people don't label themselves as such. But on the other side, on the 80% that do have a religious affiliation, there's some substantial number of people for whom that religious affiliation is pretty meaningless. It doesn't direct their lives. They don't really have any strong religious beliefs. It's hard to get a handle on how many of those people there are, but the errors in these polls run in both directions. A couple of numbers that I find telling, behavioral rather than identification or affiliation. 27% of married Americans did not have a religious service at their wedding, and 30% of Americans do not expect to have a religious funeral when they die. So those people, however they identify themselves, are obviously, religion's not playing a very big role in their lives. Only 29% say they look to their religion as a principal guide on moral and ethical issues. So the non-sectarian, non-believing population is growing, and it's going to continue to grow, and over time that's going to affect these issues. But only a small fraction of that population is militant about it. A lot of those people are simply indifferent. The religious questions are not important questions to them. There will be change over time, but my sense is it's going to be pretty slow. That would be my guess. And if we get any kind of non-sectarian requirement here, it will be non-sectarian with respect to most people in the American culture. Kind of the standard Scalia announced, but doesn't want to apply here. Yes?
Do you think if there's any type of other remedy that would be sufficient other than a non-sectarian prayer? Could the government or the town council get up and say, hey, we're going to have this prayer now by Mr. Whoever who's of this faith. We don't endorse or support any of these beliefs, but we like having these prayers because we think
right.
It has a community to see.
Yeah. So, disclaimers are hard to do well, but it could help. A disclaimer only helps if it's true, right? And a disclaimer is obviously phony and we don't believe in this stuff, but we just like the prayer is not going to help because everyone knows it's a lie, right? A disclaimer that said, and you might put this at the agenda rather than reading it out every time, and do a short version or a shorter version orally, but a disclaimer that said, the prayer is the purpose of the prayer is to seek divine guidance for the members of the board as they conduct their work tonight. It's entirely voluntary. No one is expected or required to participate. And please respect the conscientious choices of your fellow citizens who choose not to participate. That would help. That would help. The government proposed something like that, and we kind of endorsed that. I got asked about it, the oral argument. I said that would help. They could move the prayer up to the very beginning of the meeting or just before the call to order, so it'd be a little easier to arrive late, maybe a little less obvious that you're arriving late to avoid the prayer. There are things they could do to ameliorate the coercion. They can't really get rid of it as long as people are coming to petition the council for whatever redress of grievances they're coming with that night. Yeah.
I have a question kind of similar to that one, but I guess, what sort of confuses me a little bit about this case is that it seems like whether the prayer is sectarian or not and whether it's coercive or not are two separate problems.
Right.
I guess I'm wondering, does Galloway lose if the court finds or the court thinks that it's sectarian but not coercive? And the converse of that, if it's non-sectarian, of course, does Galloway lose in that case?
Right. So we said these are independent principles. It has to be non-sectarian, and it has to be non-coercive to the extent that that's possible here. But certainly, when you have both, it ought to be unconstitutional. We kind of structured the argument in layers. There are exceptions in some of the cases to each of these requirements. I was prepared to say, if pressed, yeah, there's some exceptions around the margins, but certainly where the two intersect, there's no place to make an exception. That was what we were saying. The answer to your question will depend on what Justice Kennedy decides to say, whether he likes one or both. It is conceivable that Chief Justice Roberts' vote is in play. He asked a couple of questions that were sympathetic to our side. It's conceivable that Breyer is in play in the other direction. But I think probably this is going to wind up, as everyone assumed from the get-go, as a 5-4 with Kennedy deciding. Scalia, we tried to pin him down. We quoted him over and over in a brief. We knew he would get out of it. He had trouble getting out of it. And what he finally came up with is legislators are not the government. They're just there as citizens. he may be slipping, but that was the best he could do. Right? And he acted like he'd never heard of this McCreary dissent that I kept mentioning, right? He says to me at one point, so this is a non-sectarian question, if atheists don't count, if true polytheists don't count, he'd ask earlier, what about devil worshipers? And I said, well, if they think the devil's the almighty, they might be okay, but probably they're out. And so he finally says, who decides who's in and out? And I said, I think you already decided, Your Honor. And I started quoting his opinion back to him again. But it doesn't apply here because legislators are not the government. Who else? Yes. Right.
So after this argument, looking at this case, do you feel like some of those other areas, like holiday proclamations and those other areas that have almost been grandfathered into the current jurisprudence, do you think that there's going to be some movement in those areas as well?
I wouldn't think so. I think those things really are grandfathered in. So the President's Thanksgiving proclamation every year. In God We Trust on the coins and the currency. All the religious engravings and symbols and scriptural passages that are engraved on buildings or embedded in city halls. The names of cities like Corpus Christi and Santa Fe, and Las Cruces, Body of Christ, Holy Faith, the crosses. Those aren't going to be changed. There's no way in the world the court's going to hold that kind of thing unconstitutional, and nothing in this case is likely to affect that. The ambiguity in Marsh was partly about litigation strategy by the parties back then and partly about the cryptic nature of Berger's opinion. The way the Marsh opinion is structured is part one recites the facts, part two says there's this long tradition, it's not inherently unconstitutional to have a prayer at a legislature. And then part three says, apart from claiming there can be no prayer at all, Chambers makes three specific objections. That they used the same guy for 16 years, that they paid him a salary, and that the prayers were in the Judeo-Christian tradition. He doesn't say they were Christian. He says Judeo-Christian. And then he drops a footnote, and he says, Reverend Palmer, the chaplain, Reverend Palmer describes his prayers as non-sectarian, Judeo-Christian, and with elements of the American civil religion. And seems to equate those three in the court's footnote. And then it says, the prayers used to be explicitly Christian, but he dropped all references to Christ after a Jewish legislator complaint. And then later he says, the prayers cannot be used to proselytize, advance, or disparage any one faith. But that being so, we don't need to parse the prayers. So you can imagine what the two sides did with that. And we said, look, he was only talking about non-sectarian prayer. Read the footnote. And the key word in the later sentence is one. You can't proselytize or advance any one faith. And they, of course, said, no, the prayers have been explicitly Christian for a long time. These non-sectarian prayers after the change weren't even in the record. And the key word is you can't parse the prayers. You can't look at the content of the prayers. You get to pray however you want. And a huge amount of energy in the briefs is invested in trying to tease out this language of Marsh. They got an amicus brief from Reverend Palmer. Says what I really meant was, and we said, doesn't make any difference what he thinks 30 years later he really meant. It's what the court understood, and what the court understood is in the footnote. The court was almost entirely uninterested in any of that. They don't care what Berger thought. They're going to decide for themselves what they think the right solution is. And lawyers couldn't let it go because they might have cared, but it turns out they didn't. They didn't care. Anybody else? Um, Okay. Well, I think, you know, I think I've told you most of what I can tell you. If you're curious, both the transcript of the argument and audio of the argument is on the court's website, supremecourt.gov. The transcript is faster, but the audio takes exactly an hour. They enforce the time limits. Decision will come down sometime between Monday and the end of June. My guess would be in the spring, March or April, but it literally could be any time. And this could be one of those cases where an unhappy dissenter holds it to the very end. So we will see. You do this intense amount of work, and then they voted a week ago, 2 weeks ago today, and nothing to do but wait. You can't influence it anymore. And sooner or later, we will learn what happened. I think we have a chance. I'm not optimistic. I think this specter of censoring prayer loomed pretty large for Kennedy, and I don't think we talked him out of it. So that's where we are. And if you have some question you're too shy to ask, I'll stick around for a few minutes.